Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. And today is Friday, July 5th, 2013. This is podcast number 327, and my name is Ben Stone. And my wife and I are still on the road, returning home from Pork Fest. We've been on the road now for about a month, a little over a month, and we're probably not going to be home for at least another few days, or maybe a week or so, maybe even longer than that. Who knows? We might, you know, once we get in the RV and we start rolling along, it's really difficult to stop. It's really difficult to just go home and not be in the RV anymore, because you know, it's just so nice being in the RV on the road. You know, going to campgrounds. Sometimes the campgrounds are not so great. We stayed in one campground just the other day that was not a good place at all. The one that we are in currently is a very rowdy party type atmosphere, but it's really nice campground. They have large venues. You know, they have like you know, country themed and rock themed artists that come here and do concerts and everything. I think Molly Hatchet is probably going to be their next big draw. But anyway, so that's all off the topic, just a little random rambling here. The podcast I'm going to do today, I had originally intended this to be the 4th of July podcast, and I was going to talk about basically the 4th of July. And it just didn't work out. There was a lot of things happening, and we're trying to get off the road and get into a campground, and there was heat and rain and everything that life brings at us. So it didn't happen yesterday, so it's happening today. Now, I wanted to first off talk about the founding fathers. You know, we always hear, especially around 4th of July, or any time, you know, constitutionalists start to talk, or any time somebody talks about how things ought to be in America, or how things should be, or how things would be, or how things used to be. We always hear about the founding fathers. And I just want to just spit this out. That's a lie. There were no founding fathers. No such thing ever existed. Now, there were people. There was a guy named George Washington. There was a guy named Sam Adams. There was a guy named John Adams. There was a guy named, you know, Thomas Jefferson. All these people existed. Yes, this is all true. But the concept that Americans believe in these founding fathers, these magical, these godlike creatures that that just, you know, they all agreed on one thing, and they all created this great America, that's all a lie. It's a myth. No such thing ever existed. The people that I mentioned earlier, Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Adams, the other Adams, you know, these guys agreed on almost nothing except for the fact that that they didn't want to be under the boot of British rule any longer. And that was basically the only thing they agreed on, and they didn't always agree on that. At times, you know, take the two Adamses, for example, Sam Adams and John Adams. At times, John Adams was perfectly comfortable staying under British rule. And Sam Adams was quite radical, quite violent, quite different than John Adams. You know, Sam Adams, if he existed today, he would almost certainly be considered a terrorist. He was a very violent person. I'm not saying he was a bad person. I'm saying that under today's standards, he was a terrorist. He would burn people's houses who did not politically agree with him. He organized troops, groups of men. This is well before the actual War of Independence. He would organize groups of men to go and drag shopkeepers out of their place of business, and ransack the place, break it down, set it on fire, beat the business owner, all because they, you know, they were either cooperating with one of the different taxes, or they were cooperating with the East India Company, which was, you know, the whole point being that the story that we get from public schools and from, you know, court historians, the History Channel type historians, and all the stuff that's given to us through movies, all the Hollywood nonsense, it's all a lie. Those people, in the magical, mystical way that Hollywood and the government has portrayed them, they didn't exist. Again, human beings existed with the names John Adams and Sam Adams and George Washington and so forth. Human beings existed with those names, and they did some things. But they were not these godlike, magical people who all agreed and sat around and came up with, oh, let's form a nation. Let's do. No, it didn't happen like that. So that's what I want to attack today. That's the thing that I wanted to talk about, that the founding fathers are a myth. There's no such thing. There were no founding fathers. And you always hear this. You hear, well, the framers of the Constitution believed. No, they didn't. You're wrong. You believe a lie. You have been conned. You have been had. You have been sold a bill of goods. You have been sold. In the olden days in Appalachia, they would say, you bought a pig in a poke, buddy. You bought something without examining it first. You did not look inside. And the thing that they would, where that came from, the pig and the poke, what they would do is you get a bag of baby kittens, and you sell them as, not as kittens, but as baby pigs. So the person buying this bag of what he thinks is pigs, which you're going to take home and raise them and get meat out of them and, you know, have food, instead you buy the bag and then you open it up and it's baby cats. Now, what are you going to do with a bag of cats? Like, we don't have too many cats already everywhere in Appalachia. Well, that was the point. You're when you buy a pig and a poke being an Appalachian term for a bag, you're buying something without seeing what it really is. And that's what has happened with these myths about the framers of the Constitution or the founding fathers or the fathers of our nation and all that nonsense. All of it, every bit of it, is a lie. James Madison is often called the father of the Constitution. Again, that's a lie. The actual Constitution was written before James Madison ever saw it. It was already written. James Madison had some influence on it. James Madison had a good hand in writing part of the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights. But the actual Constitution, and then this is another thing too. You hear these constitutionists, you know, as they bow and do their homage to the Constitution, and then you start to question them, how much of it have they actually read? And you start to find out that almost to a man, constitutionalists have no idea that the Bill of Rights is not the Constitution. Now think about that for a minute. The Constitution is one thing. The Constitution was written, and there was an attempt to get it passed. And there was so much pushback and so much strife over this proposed Constitution that there was great effort that took years. And guys argued and argued and threatened to kill each other. And some of them got so mad they refused to have anything to do with the whole process, and they pulled out of it altogether. And this all took place before the Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, was then added as a compromise. And even that, it was kicked around and kicked around and kicked around before they were finally able to come to some kind of a compromise and say, okay, yeah, so all these battling factions can compromise on this one thing, and we'll accept this Constitution if we put all these exceptions with it. And that's what the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, were. They were compromises and exceptions to try to explain and extrapolate out of this mess what everybody really meant. And there's no possible way. If you think about it today, you take, I think there was 50, let's see, let me look at my notes here. I think there was 53, 54 delegates. Let's see here. Stall while I'm looking this up. Yeah, there were 55 people that attended the Continental Convention. And I might just mention, out of those 55 people, 27 of them were lawyers, and 34 of them were some type of moneylenders, bankers, money speculators, land. I'll get into it another time. Maybe I'll get into it today. Maybe I won't if I don't have time. But there weren't actual banks in the U.S. in the colonies and in the new U.S. There weren't actual banks at the time. There were people who did banking. There were individuals who were money men who would loan money and who would they would go into land ventures and they would loan money on land and there were all kinds of schemes like this. And actually, Alexander Hamilton, modern banking as we know it was giving birth was birthing in the colonies right around the time of the War of Independence. People like Hamilton and some of Hamilton's top supporters formed the very first actual banks as we know them today as modern banks in the newly formed U.S. But at the time frame, the line between what was a banker, what was a loan sharker, what was a money lender, what was a pawn broker, all these things kind of blended together, and there weren't really all that good of definitions from one to the other. But of all the 55 people who were there at the Continental Convention when they considered the Constitution as a single item and when it was introduced, there were 55 there, and of those 55, 34 of them were money people, were bankers, money lenders, speculators of some kind like that. So there were 55 at the Continental Convention, and a lot of people confuse the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution. That happens all the time. Thomas Jefferson pretty much wrote the Declaration of Independence, although he borrowed a lot of material from different places and he had a lot of influences and there were other people suggesting to him, and then there was a lot of editing done to it after he finished writing it and after he brought it to the other delegates and they looked at it. But Jefferson basically wrote the Declaration of Independence, whereas the Constitution was not at all written by the guy who's often credited, who was Madison. There was actually other people before James Madison even. Well, I should. Okay, let's go into it this way. There was a scheduled convention, and this was a regular thing that was taking place, and they were going to have a look at the Articles of Confederation as they had done on several other occasions, and they were going to make some slight adjustments to it. There were some problems with the Articles. The Continental Army had run up a huge debt, and the different states were kind of stuck with these debts, and there were different schemes on how to pay for the debt, and everything from, you know, they were in some areas like Connecticut, they were in and New York, they were taxing farmers so heavily that essentially these money men, these bankers and money speculators and so forth, were essentially stealing the land of the actual soldiers who had gone off and fought in the Continental Army. And many of them either had fought without pay or they had never gotten paid for the fighting that they had done. They had been contracted and they were supposed to get paid and they didn't get paid, or they got paid less than they were supposed to, or they got paid in useless script that had devalued while they were in military service. And so they come back, and so the war's over, and they come out of the military, come back to their farm, and they find out that the state had, on the farm that they have owned for maybe a generation or longer, and they've never paid a nickel of property tax, because there was no property tax prior to the War of Independence. There was no such thing as property tax. There was, if you were a large landowner and you allowed people to come and work on your land, then there was quit rent. They would pay you a part of their crop. It was kind of like sharecropping. They would pay you a part of their crops for the privilege of getting to, you know, farm on your land. That existed in many places, especially New York, but actual property tax did not exist in the colonies. And so these soldiers come back from war, and they find out they're already, you know, behind several years in back taxes, and the state is already taking their land. Or these speculators are paying off the taxes for pennies on the dollar because the script has all been devalued. And they're just coming in and snatching up all the farmland. So there's all these ex-soldiers that are getting their farms taken away from them legally through these processes. So now imagine yourself, you've already fought, you've already expended everything that you can expend other than your life to gain freedom from an oppressive government in, you know, the Great Britain. And you come back home after the war, and here you're facing something you never faced under Britain. They're going to take your farm. And so this was the situation, and the Articles of Confederation had allowed this flaw because there was no proper way to pay all this crazy debt from the war. So in that gathering of delegates that were going to modify the Articles of Confederation to try to fix this problem of not being able to pay off all the war debt, and I'll get into the war debt a little bit more in a second, but with that as their intent, they were supposed to get together to modify the Articles of Confederation, but instead choice people were selected. Not everybody. Very choice people were selected by insiders, specifically Alexander Hamilton and George Washington, and a very small group of insiders within this coup. Really, it was a coup. They gave out very specific invitations to the people they wanted there, which didn't necessarily align with the delegates that were being sent to talk about the Articles of Confederation. So many of the people who were going to talk about the Articles of Confederation, they showed up in Philadelphia for this purpose, only to find out that the so-called Continental Convention was already underway and had been underway for maybe 6 weeks or 2 months or so before they even arrived. Not only that, they weren't invited. And when the men went into this fake Continental Convention that Alexander Hamilton and George Washington had set up, when they went in there, literally when they went in, they closed and locked the doors. And if you weren't invited, you couldn't go in. And if you were in, you couldn't get out. And they literally shuttered the windows. Which during the heat that of the summer, that wasn't all that pleasant, and there were some complaints about it. But they literally brought the select people in, locked the doors, wouldn't let anyone else in, and wouldn't let the delegates out. They shuttered the windows, and they forbid anybody from taking notes on the discussions that were taking place inside this building. Now, you think about that for a minute. As you're out there firing off your 4th of July fireworks and waving your flag and pounding yourself on the chest, you think about the fact that the guys who set up this government, the guys who formed this government, did it behind closed, locked doors and shuttered windows and demanded that no notes be taken so that everything that was said in there was said anonymously. That's the form of government you have. If you want to call those guys the founding fathers, then you need to get to know exactly what kind of creeps they were and what kind of monsters they were. Like I said, just consider for a second that of those 55, 34 of them were money men that had a vested interest in getting the kind of government set up that they wanted. These were guys who literally, and I mean, this is not hard to check out, they were the ones who were buying script at one price and then exchanging it for land for another price and swallowing up the farms of the actual soldiers that had returned from fighting. Now, this, consider it this way. Consider that you had just been in a war. I started to go down this path a second ago, and I got distracted. Consider yourself a soldier. Consider that you've taken all that you can take from the British government, and you just can't take any more from them. And so you go to war, and you spend years fighting the British, only to return home to find out you have lost everything you own, including your farm. It's gone. And the very people who were pushing you into the war are the people who now own your property, who now have your farm. And they'll let you stay on the farm if you pay them, rent. But the odds are you're just on your own. Now, a lot of people had two choices here. You could just, bow your head and go to work for somebody else. Or you could push westward and try to find land that wasn't already, that wasn't already farmed and so forth. Find wilderness and transform it into farm. And why isn't there a third choice? Why isn't revolution a possibility? Well, because you just fought about as much as a person can fight. And when you fight so long in a war, and then you find out that everything that you just fought for was thrown away, and the very people that you believed in and the very people that you fought to protect their ideas and to promote the type of government that they wanted, when you find out that that's all fake, it's all a lie, and here now is a government upon you that's worse than the one that was before, most people are not going to rise up in arms against that because why would you? When you, this, and I've said this over and over and over, and still there's people in the liberty movement who don't get this fact. When you revolt and you kick out whatever government that is in charge of you for the purpose of putting a new government in, you always get a worse government than the one you threw out. This always happens. And now it's true, I say all the time, that the so-called Revolutionary War was not a revolutionary war. It was a war of independence. But if you read the actual Declaration of Independence, you will see that Jefferson's purpose in this was very clearly stated, that they were kicking out the old government out of New England, out of the 13 colonies. Well, and that's not just New England, that includes Virginia, and you know what I mean. They're kicking the old government out in an act of independence, but as much as they are being a battle of independence, a war of independence, they are also initiating and creating a new government in the process. And immediately, before the war is even over, the new government is doing stuff that's worse than the old government. And that's what you get every single time. Every time. If you want to go and march on Washington, D.C. today and wave your flag, or you want to go down there and brandish your arms, or you want to go down there and tell those guys in Washington that you're going to be independent, or you want the government to break up and you want little independent governments to secede and you want your state to be its own government, or you want your own community to be its own government, all you're asking for is a change in the master that owns you, and you're going to get a worse one for the trade. This happens throughout history over and over and over and over. And that's what happened in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. And it came to its maturity through the passing of the Constitution and the adoption of the Constitution, when officially the government of America became worse than it had ever been under the British. And that's the true story of the War of Independence and of the signing of the Constitution. That's the real facts that took place. A small select group of 55 people, invitation only, under the authority of George Washington, who happened to have a military troop with him. You see, under any other circumstances, we would call this a coup d'etat. You have a banking leader, Hamilton, and you have a military leader, Washington. And they show up, and they bring in a select group of people that they know will back them. And they lock them into a room and swear them all to secrecy. They all had to take an oath that they would keep everything that happened inside that room secret so long as any of them were left alive. They swore that. Now think about that for a second. Those men, those 55 men who went in, not in the official Continental Congress, which was supposed to meet to talk about the Articles of Confederation. These guys met 6 to 8 weeks before the Continental Congress was supposed to happen, with their own select delegates, their own select people. And if you weren't on that list, you were not in there. It didn't matter who voted for you and who voted to send you up there to represent your community. That didn't matter. If you were on the invitation list, you were in. If you weren't, you weren't. And once you were in, you couldn't leave. Now, one of the delegates actually, if I can remember which one it was, George Wythe, W-Y-T-H-E. George Wythe was a professor of law at the College of William and Mary, and he actually taught Thomas Jefferson law. He was the professor that taught Thomas Jefferson law. And he was invited there, as were a lot of other lawyers. He was invited there to be one of those 55 men that were going to decide on the new government. And when he saw what was going on, now this is probably, George Wythe was probably considered the legal mind of North America at the time. And when he saw what was going on, he made excuses about his family. Well, I've got ill relatives and this and that, and he left. He was able to get out of there and get away from it. He refused to sign the Constitution, and he refused to be in the meetings, and he got away from it. But the other 54 did not. Now, if you ever wonder, like I was saying about, well, what about the founding fathers, they this and that? And, well, keep in mind that there were 55 delegates at the Continental Convention, the fake Continental Convention that Washington and Hamilton had set up. There were 55. Actually, one of them left. That's George Wythe. So that left 54. Now, there were 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. That was, what, 10 years before? Something like 10, 9 or 10 years prior to that? Maybe 11 years? Anyway, there were 56 signers on the Declaration of Independence. And out of those 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence and 55 attended the Continental Convention 10 years later, there were only 8 that attended both. Only 8 attended both the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the Continental Convention that brought in the Constitution. Of those 8, George Wythe was one, and he left and refused to sign. He was out of there. He didn't want anything to do with it. So that left 7 guys who were both in attendance at the signing of the Declaration and the pushing through of the Constitution. So you have these two events 10 years apart with about 50, 55 people in each of the groups. And out of all of them, only 8 men were in common. 8 men were in both events, and one of them didn't want anything to do with it and left early. That left only 7 common men. And I'll bet most people, with the exception of maybe 1 or 2 names, most people would not even recognize those 7 men that were in both of those 2 locations. One of them was Benjamin Franklin, and pretty much everybody recognizes that name. But others like George Clymer, Elbridge Gerry, Robert Morris, George Reed, Roger Sherman, James Wilson. Do you recognize any of these names? See, that's the guys that were in both of these 2 meetings. So if you want to talk about who's the founding fathers, well, the 2 events that established what we now have as the United States government, the 2 events were the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the accepting of the Constitution. And there's only 7 guys that were in both of those, and I just read their names. And Benjamin Franklin, you have to keep in mind that Benjamin Franklin was a guy who, he's very much like the chief of police, I think it was, in the movie Casablanca, where he says, I have no particular politics. I blow with the wind. And that's kind of the way Benjamin Franklin was. He was against independence until he was for independence. And then he was for independence until he was against it again. And then he was for a federal government until he was against a federal government. And then once he was against a federal government, he held that position until he became, until it was convenient for him to be for a federal government, you see. So if you realize that Benjamin Franklin had no real opinion on it, that he just blew with the wind, then that only leaves six guys that you can actually claim as your founding fathers: George Clymer, Elbridge Gerry, Robert Morris, George Read, Roger Sherman, James Wilson. When I get back from this break, I'm going to talk about those seven guys just a little bit and give you an idea of what the real founding fathers were. Stick with me, I'll be right back. Folks, there's only a finite supply of gold and silver in the world. However, politicians can print paper on a whim forever and ever. Hedge yourself against inflation and a volatile stock market by purchasing gold and silver bullion from Amagai Metals. As inflation gets worse, it will become more difficult to buy gold and silver. So secure your financial freedom today by visiting amagimetals.com. That's AmagiMetals.com. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-882-8496. That's 1-800-882-8496, where financial freedom is yours. And be sure and tell them BadQuaker.com sent you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. So we have seven men, the names of seven men: George Clymer, Elbridge Gerry, Robert Morris, George Read, Roger Sherman, and James Wilson. Now, what do we know about these guys? Well, let's start with George Clymer. George Clymer was a lawyer. Surprise, surprise. He was a banker. Wow. Isn't that amazing? He was actually the first president of the Bank of Philadelphia. He was a strong Hamilton supporter. He wrote part of the actual Constitution, not Madison, like you've been lied to and told. George Clymer wrote a good portion of the actual Constitution. Later, he was, after George Washington became president, after this coup was accomplished and George Washington became president, Clymer was appointed by Washington as his tax collector for the whiskey tax. So you see what kind of an insider this guy is, and you see what kind of a scum he is to actually be one of the tax collectors for the whiskey tax. And where do you think Washington put George Clymer? Yeah, Philadelphia. So the revolution, the tax revolt, the whiskey rebellion that took place specifically because of the actions of George Clymer. It was hate against George Clymer that actually sparked the whiskey rebellion. Of course, it was an unjust tax, and it was basically an income tax, and there was all kinds of things that were wrong with it specifically. Like, for instance, George Washington was the largest whiskey producer in the new country in America, and he was also the president who decided how the new whiskey tax was to be implemented, and I've talked about this before, but the way he rigged the tax was so that it was very light on George Washington and very heavy on the backwoods producers of whiskey, less than mainstream folks in society. Specifically, the Appalachians. And so they rebelled, and they rebelled against George Clymer. Okay, so that's George Clymer. George Clymer was a tax collector, a banker, a lawyer, and one of the actual writers, authors of the Constitution. Elbridge Gerry. Now, Elbridge Gerry was a friend of Sam Adams, and he was a close friend of John Hancock. He argued against the adoption of the Constitution, and he refused to sign it. Another thing about Elbridge Gerry is that he strongly opposed a standing army. Now, this might be a shock or it might not be a shock, but among these people that were many of the names that are very famous, Madison, Jefferson, Washington, not specifically Washington, but many of these people strongly opposed a standing army. They felt that that the first really big mistake of the country would be to have a standing army, and that a citizen militia was the only real way to make sure that the government stayed within check and stayed, kept it from being tyrannical. Many of them actually believed this. And a lot of the constitutioners today embrace some kind of theology along that lines, that somehow you can have a citizen militia that will keep government in check. But yet, the inconsistency of most of these constitutionalists is so embedded that at the same time, they'll tell you we have to have, they'll want to support the troops. They're always very, very patriotic about supporting the troops. But their own beliefs and their own systems contradict the writings and the thoughts of the people that they claim to be these magical founding fathers. A good portion of the people who lived in that time frame and who were influential in the War of Independence and the playing out of the War of Independence and the forming of the government afterwards, a lot of those people were strongly in opposition to a standing army because they saw a standing army as absolute necessity for a tyrant, but the enemy of freedom. And among people who believe that, Elbridge Gerry was one, along with, I might say, Thomas Jefferson. So we have George Clymer, who was very much for the Constitution, wrote a good portion of it, and was a nasty person. We have Elbridge Gerry, who was a pretty good guy and refused to sign the Constitution. He refused to support it. He talked against it. He fought against there being a standing army. But he was in desperation mode. He was trying his best to keep another war from breaking out. He was trying to, and it even says in the Declaration of Independence that people will as much as possible tolerate tyranny rather than face what has to happen to get rid of tyranny. So, as much as possible, people will try to compromise and try to work with tyrants to try to get things as smooth as possible without reverting to war. So that was where Elbridge Gerry was. He was there attempting to bring some sanity into this mix. Now we have Robert Morris. Surprise, surprise, Robert Morris was a banker and a close associate of Hamilton. He was actually he actually helped fund Hamilton and helped provide him with funding during the war. So of course Robert Morris was going to be there. Who else? George Read. George Read was a lawyer, a banker. He voted against independence on July 2nd, 1776. He was the only signer of the Declaration of Independence that actually voted against independence. Yet, the funny thing is, he was there at the Continental Convention to push through the Constitution, and he signed the Constitution twice. So just think about this for a minute. George Read was there present at the signing of the Declaration of Independence. He voted against signing it. Then he signed it. Then when it came around time 10 years later for the Constitution and the argument about it, he supported it so much he signed it twice. All right? So that's George Read for you. Read also supported Hamilton's push for Washington to be president for life. Now, you don't hear a lot about this nowadays, but there was a really strong push to have George Washington be president for life. And for a long time, Washington didn't say no. It was only really close to the end when he saw that he was about to lose everything anyway that he went ahead and agreed that, look, we can't do that. We have to, put some kind of a limitation and make it so that the president has to be reelected each time. But that wasn't originally Washington's plan. Originally, Washington and Hamilton were of one mind on this topic. And originally, the whole purpose of the Constitutional Convention that Hamilton set up was to place George Washington in the position of president for life. He was essentially going to be the king of America. And, you know, textbooks nowadays lie about it. They try to say, oh, no, but Washington wouldn't accept that. No, that is a lie. Washington wanted it. Washington pushed for it all the way up to the point of where he saw that the Constitution was not going to be signed unless there were limitations put on the president. Then he accepted those and pretended like he was behind him the whole time. Wow. How much of a politician does that sound like? Doesn't that sound like pretty much every politician you've ever heard of? Okay, so that was Reed. Reed was against the Declaration of Independence, signed it anyway, was for the Constitution, signed it twice, and strongly supported Hamilton's push for Washington to be president for life. That's one of your founding fathers right there. Think about that. All right, so let's get away from George Reed. Roger Sherman. Roger Sherman was a lawyer. Surprise! Who is it? The author Boston Tea Party, who likes to refer to the so-called founding fathers as the, what does he call them? The founding lawyers? Yeah, he calls them the founding lawyers. Okay, anyway, so Roger Sherman. Roger Sherman was a lawyer. He strongly supported a national standing army. He publicly advocated a high national tax. He actually went out and publicly proclaimed that there should be a high national tax. Now, how many politicians do you know of that have the audacity to openly come out and say, elect me and I'm going to raise your tax? Wait a minute, that is exactly what happens, isn't it? Yeah, amazing. So that's the kind of guy Roger Sherman was. He actually came out in the open and advocated a high national tax. He was a strong supporter of Hamilton. He was a strong supporter of Washington being president for life. And later on, once the Federalist Party developed out of Hamilton's blind greed and his obsession with power, Sherman was a supporter of the Federalists. So that's Roger Sherman. James Wilson. James Wilson was, imagine this, a lawyer and a banker. He was also a land speculator, and he was one of Hamilton's strongest supporters. He wanted a strong, powerful federal government with the power, with a powerful president for life. And guess who he wanted as president for life? You guessed it, George Washington. Now, James Wilson, like Hamilton, James Wilson referred to himself as an aristocrat, an American aristocrat. He was very proudly proclaiming this. James Wilson did this. He called himself an aristocrat. So did Hamilton. Eventually, he was director of the Bank of North America. Remember the Bank of North America that Hamilton set up? Amazing, isn't it? And also, surprisingly, James Wilson was appointed by George Washington to the Supreme Court once George Washington became president. So that's if you're looking for a founding father, James Wilson is pretty much the picture perfect reality founding father. He was at both the Continental Convention that adopted the Constitution, and he was at the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And he was also a lawyer and a banker and a land speculator. And he wanted a very powerful federal government with a president for life. And he just, by chance, he wanted that president for life to be George Washington. And somehow, he got appointed to the very first Supreme Court. Wow. So when you think about the founding fathers, take that mythology, take that silly religion of statism that you've been taught since you were a child, that the movies taught you and that the schools taught you and that that has been pushed on you your whole life. Take that whole idea and flush it down the toilet where it belongs, because it's all lies. It's all crap. Don't believe any of it. If you have to have founding fathers, the only eight people who were both at the signing of the Declaration of Independence and at the adoption of the Constitution are those eight that I said, of which most people have only heard of Benjamin Franklin, and that was a guy that I don't have a lot of respect for. And out of the eight, One walked away, wouldn't have anything to do with it, and that was George Wythe. And he was probably the best educated and probably the best legal mind of the day in America. And he walked away from it, didn't want anything to do with it. So that left the scum that I just read to you, and those are the closest thing to founding fathers that America has. They were the founding lawyers, as Boston Tea Party puts it. So then the actual Continental Convention where the Constitution was adopted, like I said before, it was by invitation only. It was not the main delegates that were supposed to show up weeks and even months later for the actual Continental Convention. It was by invitation only. Washington rode into town on his horse with his men with him, with his detachment of personal guard that went with him everywhere. Think of Napoleon and think of Julius Caesar riding into Rome on his chariot. Think of Napoleon marching into Paris with his elite guard surrounding him. That's the image you should have of George Washington marching into Philadelphia with his troops right around him and marching up and taking possession. That's the image you should have in your mind of a coup d'etat, of a military man and a banker, Hamilton and Washington, coming in together and taking over the convention ahead of time using only invitation-only people, locking the doors. And how do you lock the doors and shutter all the windows and do that and force people to stay in through the heat of summer to hash this thing out? How do you do that without some kind of force of arms? You see, you never see in any imagery that's put across, that's given to us by Hollywood or given to us by government schools or whatever, you never see any imagery of military standing guard inside and outside of the hall to prevent anyone from coming or going. You never see any depiction of the Continental Convention where the military were actually inside making sure no one took notes. Imagine an organization like that taking place. Imagine 55 people being essentially kidnapped and put into this room, held by a detachment of military, and essentially threatened and forced to cooperate and to put their names behind this new government that was being formed. And somehow, the top guy that comes out of it is the guy who runs the military at the time, who comes into town on his white horse and with his detachment and takes over the building and does this thing. This is, under any circumstances, this would be called a coup d'etat. This was not some kind of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It was a military action that seized control of a weak government. That's exactly what took place. I think it's, I keep using this phrase, a coup d'etat. I think it's a good thing to read a definition. A coup d'etat is the sudden disposition of a government by a small group of the existing establishment, typically the military, to depose the extant government and replace it with another body, civil or military. A coup d'etat is considered successful when the usurpers establish their dominance. When the coup neither fails completely nor succeeds, a civil war is usually the consequence. So, was there a revolution in 1776? No, there was not a revolution in 1776. There was a secession. There was a war of independence. And at the end of that war of independence, then came the revolution. But the revolution was internal. It would have been a civil war, except for the fact that the coup d'etat was successful, and the switch that took place did not require a war, because the ones who should have stood up, you know, you think of it as Julius Caesar coming into Rome, and the existing government that was there saw that they had created an emperor. They had created a monster. And so what did they do? Each of the senators, as Julius Caesar entered the Senate, each of the senators ritually stabbed Julius Caesar. each one of them having blood on their hands, each one of them being a part of the deed to kill Julius Caesar. Well, if the so-called founding fathers had really believed what they had fought for, fought against the British, if they really believed that, why didn't they meet Washington with the same greeting that Julius Caesar was given? Now, let me just point out something, though. When that happened with Julius Caesar, a worse government took over. Because that's what revolution brings, always. You see these people in the liberty movement who say, "This is gonna, we're going to have a revolution. We want a revolution. We need a revolution. There's going to be a revolution. This is the beginning of a revolution. There's a new American revolution." All that nonsense, it will only produce a worse situation. There, you know, I'm not going to go into the solution today because I talk about it all the time. But there is a solution. But the solution is not revolution. You can't make peace through violence. You can't improve the world through more aggression. You can't come up with a better master by killing your master. This is just not the way it's done, folks. Revolution is not the answer. It wasn't the answer in 1776. It wasn't the answer in 1787, I think it was, at the Constitutional Convention. It wasn't the answer then. It wouldn't have been the answer to kill Washington, although, you know, it could be argued that if they were consistent in their logic, they would have killed Washington. But again, that wouldn't have actually solved the problem. Because the problem is in the mind. The problem is believing this idea that you need a government to do all these different things in life. It's just not necessary. That's where the problem lies. It's in changing the mindset, not in changing who the big man is, not in changing who the great leader is. It's in the mind of changing whether you need a great leader, whether you need the great man to be your God and to guide the nation and all these other things like this that we're told. Now, I want to go back to this just for a minute because I didn't really emphasize it enough earlier when I talked about it. So many people, when they talk about the Constitution is this, the Constitution is that, the framers of the Constitution wanted this, or the framers of the Constitution meant to say this, or the America would be great if we'd get back to the Constitution. All that nonsense comes out of the mouths of people typically who don't even know the difference between the actual Constitution and the Bill of Rights that were amendments to the Constitution to make it more palatable, to make it more politically feasible, to make it easier to sell to the general public. That's what the Bill of Rights were. They were a sales ploy to try to get a product sold to the American people. And so when you read something like the Federalist Papers, you'll always hear this, not always, but very often you'll hear the Federalist Papers quoted. Oh, no, the Constitution is supposed to be like this because it says so in the Federalist Papers. Folks, believing the Federalist Papers is like trusting a used car salesman. Like you're standing here talking to the used car salesman, and he's like, "Oh, honestly, this is the best car on the lot. You're not going to find a car this nice for this kind of price anywhere else in town." Really? You're believing the guy who has a vested interest in selling you the car. Well, that's exactly what the Federalist Papers were. They were written by Hamilton and his little group of associates who had every reason to sell a con on the American people. So they were willing to say anything, do anything to get the American people to accept this Constitution. Why? Because they had massive amounts of money invested in it, and they had a lot of money to gain if their scheme went through. And their scheme went through, and they did gain a lot of money from this. Don't kid yourself, folks. Washington became a very rich man over this. Hamilton would have, had he lived long enough, he would have been a very wealthy man. He was already a very wealthy man due to the scheme itself. And he lived way longer than he should have. Aaron, that's the one failure of Aaron Burr, is that he took 20, 30 years to do what should have been done earlier. But again, you know, even had he done that, it doesn't solve the ultimate problem. The ultimate problem is in the belief of the necessity of government, not in the fact that the tyrant exists. The tyrant only exists because you believe in him, because you let him be there. Okay, so like I said, believing the Federalist Papers is like trusting a used car salesman. Except here's a thing to think about. when the Federalist Papers were being pushed around, when they were being copied and they were being distributed all around the new, you know, all around the new country that had been that had broke free from England, when this was taking place, they were all anonymous. Most people didn't have any idea who the writers of the Federalist Papers were. They didn't know that the Federalist Papers were being pushed on them by the very used car salesman who had Hamilton, who had pushed this through to begin with. So literally, you know, he pushed through this coup, and then in an attempt to get it legitimized, he wrote the Federalist Papers under an assumed name as an anonymous personality, and then published those out and tried to use those as a way to convince people that, hey, this Constitution thing is probably going to be okay because here's this guy over here I never heard of that says it's good. Now, at the time, there were a lot of voices against this Constitution and a lot of voices against Hamilton. John Taylor of Caroline wrote extensively condemning Hamilton and his cronies. He wrote a thing called Tyranny Unmasked. And now there was this oath that was taken when they all came together and they're surrounded by the military. They're inside this little hot building with the windows boarded shut and the doors locked and everything, and they're surrounded by military, and they're forced to take an oath that neither would they take any notes nor would they speak about or quote anything that had happened within that meeting during the lifetime of all those people. So after they started dying, they hadn't all died, but after they started dying, some of the widows and other family members of the people from that were in that Continental Congress, some of those people began to reveal the private stories of what took place. And most of that was repressed. Most of that was shut down by force. As a matter of fact, things like the alien and sedition laws were used to shut people up and make them not talk about that. But one of the things that took place, and this was years later, was that John Taylor of Caroline wrote Tyranny Unmasked. And this came out after the truth of the drafting of the Constitution was finally beginning to be told by widows and family members and so forth. And so if you really – I'm pretty sure you could probably find it online. I think I have a PDF version of it. But if you get your hands on Tyranny Unmasked by John Taylor of Carolina, then you're going to understand a viewpoint from that time frame as to how horrible this whole Constitution thing was and how underhanded it was in the pushing it through on the American people. And again, the only reason there wasn't open rebellion against it, the only reason there wasn't war against it was two things. First off, everybody was so sick of being at war for so long, and they saw that it had not accomplished what they had hoped. And the other thing was, George Washington still had a military presence. He still had this core group of fanatic followers who literally went around with him everywhere he went. They were his personal guard that just went around with him like Napoleon had his and like Caesar had his and like all other despots throughout time have done. That was what Washington was really like. That's the real man. So Washington and Hamilton, they get control of the government. And once they do, immediately they throw through the whiskey tax. Immediately, Washington orders the aggressive invasion of Ohio and the falsification of information to pursue Indian wars in Ohio. This is exactly what Washington did as soon as he was elected, as soon as he got power. John Adams, as soon as he got power, he pushes through the alien and sedition laws, which make it so that they can just snatch up anybody who talks, who just says anything. Like one guy said something about the president being a fat little guy from Boston. Bang, that guy's in jail. That's all it takes. You refer to John Adams as a fat little bald guy, he has you arrested. That's the level of tyranny that these guys inflicted within the first two presidencies. James Madison, the so-called father of the Constitution, I already debunked that, but he actually did have authored quite a bit of the Bill of Rights. He's the guy who lied to the public to go to war in the War of 1812, which was actually the First World War. It was pretty much identical. It was the Napoleonic Wars were going on. It was pretty much identical to what was happening in what we now call the First World War. Well, Madison was the guy who lied to the American public to go in on the side of Napoleon and try to distract the English with war. So the War of 1812 was an aggressive war initiated by the United States on Great Britain, actually through the invasion of Canada. Madison attempted to invade Canada. That's what sparked the War of 1812. So he lies about it. He fights a war of aggression. Then he fails and surrenders to the British. Keep in mind, the United States government lost the War of 1812, and Madison surrendered to the British and promised that the United States would never invade Canada again. The other thing Madison did was he signed the bill to charter the Second National Bank after the first one expired. Because Madison had run up such a huge debt in the War of 1812, he needed fake money to pay for it. Now, there's a lot of good things you can say about things that Madison said and did later in his life. But Madison was very much a man of two minds. He could be swayed in either direction, but deep in his heart, he was that tyrant. He was that guy who wanted to go to war and who wanted an American empire to conquer the world with. That was Madison. That was Washington. That was Hamilton. That was John Adams. If you want founding fathers, there they are for you. Tyrants, the whole lot of them. Folks, thanks for listening today. And if I sounded a little angry, it's because I just had to tolerate the 4th of July and all the nonsense that goes along with it. So, folks, thanks for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much.